Good morning, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan with today's Wall Street Journal. Economy. The U.S. economy is regaining its swagger. Consumers are spending again after the spring's tariff chill, but some expect growth to be slow, by Rachel Wolf and Conrad Putzier. When President Trump slapped tariffs on nations across the globe this spring, many economists feared higher prices and spending cuts would flatten the economy. Consumer sentiment collapsed. The S&P 500 stock index fell by 19% between February and April. The world held its breath and waited for the bottom to drop out. But that didn't happen. Now businesses and consumers are regaining their swagger, and evidence is mounting that those who held back are starting to splurge again. The stock market is reaching record highs. The University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index, which tumbled in April to its lowest reading in almost 3 years, has begun climbing again. Retail sales are up more than economists had forecast, and sky-high inflation hasn't materialized, at least not yet. "We've been surprised again and again by consumers," said Jonathan Miller, senior U.S. economist at Barclays. In April, Miller predicted that the U.S. economy would likely go into recession this year. He now expects it to keep growing, albeit at a slow pace. As soon as Donald Trump was elected, Tyler Ahn decided she wasn't going to take any chances with the possibility of tariffs, or worse, a broader economic collapse. The 46-year-old product manager stocked up, buying survival gear, flashlights, window-breaking devices, and water purification tablets, a mop bucket, and an entire case of French rosé. Throughout the rest of the winter and early spring, Ahn sat tight, trying to spend as little as possible while attempting to follow Trump's evolving tariff threats. But recently she gave up. "I decided, well, it is what it is. My money will buy what it will buy," said Ahn, who is based in Portland, Oregon. "What am I going to do? I've got to live." She just got back from a 2-week trip to Italy and France. Even with a weaker dollar, she said she spared no expense on hotels, meals, and gelato. There are still signs of turbulence in the U.S. economy. Growth has been subdued. Inflation, while down from pandemic peaks, is still higher than the Federal Reserve would like. Manufacturing activity shrank for the fourth straight month in June, and immigration raids are damping spending among Hispanic consumers. Trump has repeatedly delayed the higher tariffs for imports from many countries he threatened in April, and the risk of fallout from steeper levies still looms. Earlier this month, he threatened 30% tariffs on imports from the European Union and Mexico starting August 1. Still, companies and consumers have brightened their outlook from earlier this year. JPMorgan Chase reported unexpectedly strong earnings last week and said the bank's economists are no longer expecting a recession. "After the initial shock of tariff policy changes, everyone kind of went on hold," said Jeremy Barnum, the bank's chief financial officer. "But at a certain moment, you just have to move on with your life. And it does feel like some of it is happening just because you can't delay forever." The bank said card spending grew 7%. Elsewhere, Bank of America, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs reported rising profits, while United Airlines noted improved travel demand. A busy slate of earnings in the coming weeks will help create a fuller picture. In a July survey of 1,267 U.S. small business owners by digital marketing platform Constant Contact, 44% of respondents said demand for services and products is higher than they anticipated in January. A third were extremely optimistic that their business would be performing better in the next 3 months, and just under a third thought they would add more employees by then. There are signs of weakness in the labor market, where hiring by private employers has been sluggish. But the unemployment rate, 4.1% in June, remains low by historical standards, because employers have also been reluctant to cut jobs. Spring is traditionally the busiest season for new client enrollment at Command Education, a college admissions consulting firm for high schoolers based in New York City. Not this year. Chief Executive Christopher Rim said the firm logged more signups during the first week of July than in any full month since January. The reason? wealthy clients who saw their stock portfolios shrink in March and April weren't about to drop $85,000 minimum for a year of services. The market was so iffy, they were like, let me see just how this plays out, Rim said. Now they are ready. Two new employees joined Command's existing staff of 49 last week, and another new hire starts soon. Rim hopes to fill 5 additional full-time roles before summer's end. It's been insane, Rim said, adding that one of his salespeople canceled a planned week-long vacation to catch up on intake calls. July is never like this. Consumers' spring pessimism reflected expectations for a tariff-fueled inflation surge. Those fears have since eased. Respondents in this month's University of Michigan survey said they expect inflation of 4.4% in the coming year. In April, they expected 6.6% inflation. But even with delays on some of Trump's threats, he still has pushed overall effective tariff rates to the highest level in more than a century. The effective tariffs could still be on the way. During the first Trump administration, tariff increases announced in 2018 didn't start showing up in capital spending until the second half of 2019, said Michael Feroli, chief U.S. economist at J.P. Morgan. Some of these things take a while, he said. Inflation ticked up slightly in June, and prices of tariff-sensitive items such as toys, clothes, and furniture rose, a sign that businesses are starting to pass the cost of these levies on to customers. Aaron Anderson, the owner of East Coast brunch restaurant franchise Sunrise Social, said tariffs and high interest rates are still keeping him cautious about the prospect of shelling out on large projects like opening new locations. But instead of pulling back entirely, he has been investing more heavily in marketing, staffing, and trying to improve customer experience at his existing locations. I'm still optimistic long-term, said Anderson. Christian Reed, who launched his Boston-based tools business as the COVID-19 pandemic took off, said this spring was even more chaotic. He paused new product manufacturing then due to tariff threats because his business, Recon Tools, works with factories in China, Thailand, and other affected countries. The company was in a holding pattern to see what was going to happen, Reed said. By early July, Reed said he had two revelations. Extreme upheaval in prices and consumer spending wasn't happening, and he was sick of waiting for certainty that seemed like it would never arrive. His outlook as a consumer began to shift too. He and his wife, who have a second child due in October, were holding off on upgrading their Mazda CX-5 to a larger SUV that could more comfortably fit 2 car seats, plus their black lab and an Italian Greyhound. There was all the hyperbole that cars were going up by 10,000%, Reed said, but it seemed like none of that really happened. They are planning to buy a Lexus or Volvo SUV next month. Germany shut down thousands of air raid shelters. It needs new ones fast. The country is scrambling to roll back a decision to decommission bunkers as military experts warn that Russia could be in a position to attack Western Europe within years. By Bertrand Benoit. As part of its effort to become war-ready by 2029, Berlin is scouting public places that can be turned into shelters quickly and cheaply. Less than 20 years ago, Germany decided the risk of a military attack on its territory was so low that it decommissioned the country's last air raid bunkers. Today, it is scrambling to roll back the decision. Of about 2,000 bunkers and air raid shelters operational during the Cold War, only 580 remain, offering space for 480,000 people, or 0.5% of Germany's population. Even this figure is largely theoretical. Maintenance and servicing of civil protection equipment is no longer taking place, a government spokesman said. The country's remaining shelters, including Berlin's 4 faculties, are neither functional nor operational, he added. With military experts warning that Russia could be in a position to attack Western Europe within years, this leaves millions of civilians defenseless if there is a conflict similar to the war in Ukraine, in which Moscow is bombing cities almost daily. Now German authorities are rushing to remedy the situation, drawing up lists of public spaces that can be rapidly and cheaply turned into shelters while planning sturdier protection further into the future. A pilot project aims to provide bomb shelters for 1 million people by the end of 2026. Spurred by Russia's invasion of Ukraine and threats toward the West, Germany has pledged to become war ready by 2029. Its military spending is set to almost double by then. But the effort isn't just about loading up on tanks and drones. It is also about ensuring civilians are prepared and protected in case of an attack. When I ask my friends what their stockpiling situation is, how much water, food, and medication they have in the basement, the usual joke is that they have enough red wine to last for a year, said Tim Stuckey, executive director of the Brandenburg Institute for Society and Security. But it's not enough for the Bundeswehr to be ready, he added, referring to the German armed forces. So must the whole of society. Operation Plan Germany, a classified document drawn up in 2024, was designed to ensure that the country can function as a staging ground for the hundreds of thousands of North Atlantic Treaty Organization troops in a war. Officials said the plan outlines which roads and bridges can sustain heavy military traffic, as well as steps to shield critical infrastructure and ensure the government and the economy can operate under sustained attack. Bunkers are a key part of the plan, yet analysts say the government is just beginning to spell out what these should look like. The government must define what it considers the threat to be, and secondly, what should be protected against this threat, said Norbert Gebken, head of the Risk Research Center at the University of the Bundeswehr in Munich. Neither of these questions has been answered yet. Authorities are still working on a study to answer these questions, Gebken said, but the required bunkers will likely range from deep, highly reinforced underground facilities housing critical government functions to basic shelters protecting civilians from drone attacks, he added. One of the most enduring marks left by World War II on German cities, more enduring even than the destruction caused by Allied bombardments, is the ubiquitous Huck bunker, gray, windowless hulks of reinforced concrete that used to house anti-aircraft batteries, telephone terminals, or civilian shelters. Almost indestructible, many have been sold over the years and turned into art galleries, clubs, hotels, and luxury properties. A former World War II communications bunker in Berlin now houses the Furell Collection of Asian Antiquities. One of its gloomy exhibition halls features an underground lake. Beyond a few exceptions, renovating those in Germany's mostly underground Cold War bunkers, the largest of which could house several thousand people, would be expensive and slow, and in some cases may offer only limited protection. Large concentrations of people could also become targets in an era in which attacks on civilians have become routine. German officials said Ukraine's experience showed that the main risk for civilians was being hit by missile shrapnel or drones, hence the need for a decentralized approach. Many smaller spaces that are protected from direct hits and can be reached within minutes of the alarms being given, not vast underground bunkers, would need hours to fill. The idea is to use existing spaces and reinforce them, for instance, by strengthening a basement ceiling to bear the weight of rubble, said Gebken. These places can have other uses, but they need some work done on them. They aren't entirely improvised. This is what we know from Israel and other places. The Interior Ministry, the Federal Office of Civil Protection and Disaster Assistance, and the federal government's property arm are working on specifications for how to turn existing buildings into functional shelters. Meanwhile, regional authorities are drawing up lists of suitable spaces, from underground parking garages to subway stations and basements. Once enough are found and fitted, ideally with camp beds, sanitation, drinking water, and air filtration, to protect 1 million people by the end of next year, the program will be scaled up, according to a government spokesman. Authorities are also developing an app that would instruct civilians on how to get to the closest shelter as well as recommendations for turning private rooms into shelters. More Germans are turning to specialized construction companies to discuss converting their basements into private bunkers. The whole topic was more of a source of jokes for many years, said Peter Arnhammer, whose company DSZ makes everything from panic rooms to fully autonomous underground nuclear shelters with radiation protection and independent power and water supplies. Things are changing because of developments in Ukraine, Russia, but also our changing relations to the U.S., Germany's rearmament, the Middle East, he added. A robust civil protection isn't just about saving lives in case of war, said Stuckey of the Brandenburg Institute. It can also make war less likely. By signaling that we are taking on the challenge of Russia's aggression, that we are both able and willing to defend our values, we contribute to our deterrent, said Stuckey. We're basically telling Russia, don't even think about it. Why Israel's chaotic new food program in Gaza has turned so deadly. Visit to one distribution site shows how system designed to squeeze out UN and Hamas continues to draw hungry Palestinians into deadly encounters, by Dov Lieber and Anat Peled. Khan Yunis, Gaza Strip. Thousands of hungry Palestinians amassed last Thursday morning outside a barbed wire fence surrounding the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation Aid Center here. The moment the gates cracked open, the crowd surged forward. American security contractors tried to keep control, but scores of men pushed through barricades and snatched boxes of food awaiting distribution. Others sprinted in behind them. Men on speeding motorcycles raced past the pedestrians to grab whatever food they could. Gunshots rang out. It wasn't clear from where. Within about 15 minutes, all the food was gone. Chaotic scenes like that one, witnessed by a Wall Street Journal reporter, have plagued the new food distribution system run by an Israeli-backed foundation known as the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Since the program began 2 months ago, hundreds of people have died and hundreds more have been wounded trying to get food from the four GHF sites, according to local health authorities. Israel's military acknowledged opening fire on crowds that come too close to its troops. As the death toll has climbed, the United Nations, many humanitarian organizations, and more than 20 governments have condemned the new approach, which supplanted a much larger UN effort. Israel said the new system is intended to prevent Hamas from diverting aid to fuel its operations. Anyone who hasn't witnessed a scene on the ground here might wonder how such violence could result from a food distribution operation. The journal's observation of one morning's distribution effort, from when it kicked off to when it was overrun, reveals some reasons why the setup has been so beset with problems. For starters, GHF relies on the Israeli military nearby to provide security and keep its workers safe, which brings sometimes desperate Palestinian crowds into close proximity with troops. The UN's food distribution points, by contrast, usually didn't have Israeli troops nearby. A second big problem is that the demand for food far outstrips GHF's current capacity, resulting in overwhelming numbers of people fighting to get their hands on scarce rations. Aid-related violence also has broken out far from GHF sites. On Sunday, dozens of Palestinians were killed or wounded as they sought aid, passing into northern Gaza from Israel, according to local health authorities. The Israeli military said thousands of Gazans had gathered in the north of the strip, and it fired warning shots to remove a threat posed to soldiers. The military disputed the casualty numbers reported by Gazan authorities. There were no reported casualties at the GHF site on the outskirts of Khan Yunis on the day the journal visited. GHF said its post-operation reported for that Tuesday didn't show any shooting by its security contractors. Their shots are audible on a video taken by the journal. Israeli soldiers weren't present at the site itself, though there was a tank nearby. But the next day, last Wednesday, at least 20 people were killed in a crush at the site, according to health authorities and GHF. GHF said that its security contractors had pepper-sprayed people rushing the site that day. Ahmad Tarek El Dohidi was one of those trying to get food that day. I couldn't breathe from the smell, he recalled. I didn't get anything and ran away. There were lots of children, women, and elderly people. I saw about 15 dead bodies. Israel Ziv, a retired Israeli general who once headed Israel's Gaza division, said, "The area is not stable. It's under chaos. The threat of starvation under those conditions is so severe that there's no way you can create a stable system in unstable surroundings." Gunfire threat. Israeli soldiers interviewed by the journal said they have fired rifles, machine guns, and even artillery when crowds veered off approved routes to GHF sites or took shortcuts. Soldiers said shots are fired around crowds to ward them off, but also at times directly at people who move in their direction. Israel's military said it tries to avoid using gunfire and reviews each incident to learn from them to reduce harm. Israeli military officials said troops have caused deaths, but some said the Palestinian authorities' numbers are inflated. One Israeli reservist said in an interview he saw soldiers firing toward Gazans carrying white flags who veered off an approved route in mid-June. "We have an unwritten rule that if you are worried and they get too close and you see that it could be something that puts you and your team at risk, you don't take that risk," he said. He said soldiers warned people not to come closer, but they continued. Once the crowd passed what the soldiers considered a red line, the soldiers opened fire. They are told to fire warning shots in the air or to shoot at people's knees, but mistakes happen, he said. A GHF spokesperson said that it has repeatedly asked the Israeli military to improve the safety of access routes to the sites, and that in recent weeks the military has taken steps to do so. Last month, the military said it would change the way it operates and add signs and fencing in hopes of minimizing friction with the population. During the journal's visit to the site outside Khan Yunis, a trip organized by Israel's military, none of that was evident, and the troops made no effort to control crowds. "Every day, our team shows up to do one thing, feed the people of Gaza," GHF said in a written statement. GHF is currently the only organization consistently delivering food to civilians in Gaza, and the heavy crowds at our distribution sites reflects that reality. Previously, food had been amassed by the UN and private charities and distributed primarily by the UN at about 400 sites in population centers around Gaza. The UN still brings in some food, but much less than before. The new aid plan was designed by a group of about a dozen Israeli reservists and businessmen who began meetings as early as December 2023 in an effort to sideline the UN, according to people who took part in the discussions. It got a green light when a new defense minister, Israel Katz, was appointed and President Trump was elected in the U.S., a former senior military officer who helped design the plan said. Before the launch, some Israelis familiar with the plan warned senior officials the plan didn't include enough sites and they weren't located properly, raising the potential for dangerous overcrowding and violence, according to documents reviewed by the journal and one of the people who raised concerns. GHF, the foundation that runs the program, was incorporated in Delaware in February and currently is led by Johnny Moore, an American businessman, evangelical Christian leader, and former Trump campaign advisor. GHF has contracted Safe Reach Solutions, established in Wyoming in November, to provide security for the sites. It isn't clear how the program has been funded. Some countries and many humanitarian organizations have refused to work with it, crimping sources of international help. The U.S. State Department approved $30 million for GHF in June, but it has yet to be dispersed, a department spokesperson said. Israel launched the program after blocking food shipments into Gaza for 11 weeks, an embargo that ran down stockpiles and led to widespread concern about starvation. GHF operates mainly in southern Gaza and is meant to serve around 1 million people. Israel hopes to deprive Hamas of a source of income, but Israel doesn't know who is actually picking up the aid at its sites and the restrictions it has put on food supplies is deepening its international isolation. The European Union has threatened to downgrade relations with Israel, largely over humanitarian aid. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant has been accused in the International Criminal Court of using starvation as a weapon. The plan has become a public relations disaster for international firms that advised on the project, including the Boston Consulting Group, which fired partners who worked on it. GHF's previous executive director, Jake Wood, a U.S. military veteran, quit just before the project launched. Hunger crisis. The entire population of Gaza faces shortages of food. The UN Relief and Works Agency said 10% of children screened at its sites were malnourished, and the World Food Program said tens of thousands need treatment related to malnourishment. GHF said its food boxes include things like flour, pasta, sugar, rice, cooking oil, beans, tuna, tea, cookies, and potatoes. Palestinians said the handouts vary by the day and typically don't contain nutrients such as animal protein. Jamil Al-Nahal, a 21-year-old from Rafah who has sought food at GHF sites, said if he is lucky, he comes away with flour, lentils, and cooking oil. The crowds are huge and the quantities are tiny, he said. I am responsible for my father, mother, and sisters. The amount I bring back lasts a day or two at most. Israel has said it has plans to expand the number of distribution sites, but hasn't said when or where. GHF's four sites aren't always open, and it can be hard for Palestinians to know which ones will have food. The operators try to control the crowds with fences and gates, but distribution is typically disorderly, and supplies vanish quickly, leading to melees. On the program's first day, tens of thousands of Gazans overran the Khan Yunis site, flooding through a small opening after the gate collapsed and forcing the roughly 40 people working as security contractors on site to retreat. They stripped the site of everything, including fencing, light bulbs, and a generator, as the Israeli military and U.S. contractors watched from a shared situation room. After that, the Israeli military decided to enforce a red line about a mile away from the Khan Yunis compound to prevent crowding at the entrance before trucks could be unloaded. Suddenly, the crowds of civilians moving through Gaza before dawn to reach the site before they opened were running into Israeli forces tasked with holding them back. On Saturday, more than 20 Palestinians were killed on their way to the aid sites, according to local health authorities. The Israeli military acknowledged opening fire around a kilometer away from an aid site. Some soldiers said in interviews that anyone who veered off the regular path toward the Israeli position, either because they wanted to take a shortcut or got lost, was considered a threat and fired upon. At times, it put the crowds behind them in the line of fire, they said. When about 1,500 to 2,000 people came through a very small entrance, and they are all stressed and pushing, it comes to warning shots. Or when they cross a certain boundary, it comes to warning shots, one of the soldiers said. It's an uncomfortable situation. GHF has repeatedly blamed Hamas for some of the violence. Last week, it said it had credible reason to believe the stampede that led to the deaths on Wednesday had been sparked by Hamas-affiliated elements in the crowd. Hamas has repeatedly threatened Palestinians who cooperate with the plan with violence. Last month, GHF said Hamas militants attacked a busload of its Palestinian staff, killing at least eight. This month, GHF and the Israeli military said they suspected that Hamas militants had injured two American security staffers with grenades. In ongoing talks over a ceasefire, one of Hamas's primary demands has been an end to the GHF program and a return to aid distribution via the UN and humanitarian organizations. Tension has mounted between GHF and the Israeli military, with each side blaming the other for the chaos. Last week, the military said it stopped enforcing its line around the distribution center near Khan Yunis, where the stampede occurred. GHF said its security contractors would assume responsibility for crowd control close to the site. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. It isn't clear whether Israel has made similar changes at other sites. A video taken on Friday and geolocated by investigative group Bellingcat a few hundred yards from a separate GHF distribution site showed tanks and aid seekers fleeing as shots were heard. The military said it had fired warning shots to hold back individuals it perceived as a threat to its forces. GHF devised a plan to use flags to better signal whether a site was open or closed, so people would know when it was safe to approach. A red flag meant a site would stay closed, and a green flag meant it would be open. Last Tuesday, inside the makeshift military base near the distribution site, soldiers monitored a drone feed that showed tensions rising in the crowd outside the distribution center as aid workers began handing out boxes of food to people at the entrance. Throughout the process, the flag remained red. Exclusive Europe. Europe prepares for U.S. trade fight. The European Union still wants a deal, but with U.S. demands growing, the bloc is getting ready to push back. By Kim Mackerel and Bertrand Benoit. Brussels. The European Union thought it was on the verge of a deal with the U.S. to keep tariffs in check. Now it is readying for a counterattack. U.S. officials told the EU's trade chief this past week that they expect President Trump to demand further concessions from the bloc to get an agreement, including a baseline tariff on most European goods, that could be in the range of 15% or higher, according to people briefed on the talks. That was an unwelcome surprise for the EU, which had been working toward an agreement that would have kept the baseline tariffs at 10%, already a tough concession for some of its 27 countries. The shift prompted Germany, Europe's biggest economy and its largest exporter, which had previously been more dovish on U.S. retaliation, to swing closer to France's more confrontational position, according to people close to the discussions. Now, EU member states are pressing the bloc's executive body to prepare new and potent measures to hit back against U.S. companies beyond retaliatory shifts on goods if a deal can't be reached by the August 1 deadline set by Trump, the people said. All options are on the table, a German official said Friday. The official said there was still time to negotiate a deal, but added, if they want war, they will get war. The push to increase potential countermeasures marks a turning point for the EU after months of negotiations to salvage the world's biggest trading relationship. More than $5 billion of goods and services moves between the two economies every day, according to EU data. The European Commission, which is in charge of the bloc's trade policy, said Sunday that it wants a negotiated, mutually beneficial agreement and remains deeply engaged in negotiations. If no satisfactory outcome is found, all options remain on the table, a spokesman said. On Sunday, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick expressed optimism about reaching an agreement with the EU. I am confident we'll get a deal done, Lutnick said on CBS's Face the Nation. And it will be great for America because the president has the back of America. In the months since Trump took office, EU trade chief Marcos Sefcovic has flown to Washington half a dozen times. He has had multiple calls and texts with U.S. trade officials, and he has said Europe was willing to lower tariffs and buy tens of billions of dollars of U.S. energy products and advanced semiconductors. The bloc has little to show for his efforts. Earlier this month, Trump threatened 30% tariffs on imports of most goods from the EU, up from the 20% the president first floated in April. Even German officials, who have pressed for a quick deal, no longer see an agreement with the U.S. as the most likely outcome, people familiar with the matter said. On Friday, Berlin signaled it could support the EU using so-called anti-coercion instrument, a legal tool that lets the bloc hit back at economic bullying with a range of restrictions on trade and investment. It has never been used before. EU officials view the tool as the bloc's most powerful trade weapon and a last resort. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who leads the EU's executive arm, said earlier this month that the instrument was created for emergencies and we are not there yet. That assessment could change. The Commission is already preparing measures that could be introduced using the anti-coercion instrument, people briefed on the matter said. After Šefčovičs returned to Washington, more member states now say they want the tool to be ready. The measures that are being readied include possible levies or other restrictions on U.S. digital services and curbs on American companies' access to the bloc's public procurement market, the people said. That would be in addition to measures the EU has already prepared. The EU earlier drew up two packages on tariffs targeting more than $100 billion of U.S. exports to the bloc, ranging from airplanes to peanut butter and whiskey, although they haven't been put into effect. The second package still needs formal sign-off from member states, but both could be activated quickly if needed, officials have said. European officials and member states still hope a deal is possible. The bloc doesn't plan to launch any retaliation before Trump's August 1 deadline, and the preparation of measures that could be introduced using the anti-coercion instrument doesn't necessarily mean the tool will be deployed. But they are gearing up for a possible fight that they acknowledge could have heavy costs for both sides in a commercial relationship that is valued at trillions of dollars. The deal the two sides were nearing earlier this month would have set the EU offer to boost purchases of U.S. energy products and semiconductors and accept a 10% baseline tariff on most goods. Some elements were still being negotiated, people familiar with the talks said. Those factors included which sectors to exempt from the baseline tariff and what relief Europe's car industry might get from the 25% tariffs it currently faces. Still, the Commission was optimistic. While other U.S. trading partners had received letters outlining higher tariffs they would soon face, Šefčovič told lawmakers on July 9th, our negotiations have spared the EU from facing higher tariffs. 3 days later, Trump posted a letter on social media threatening the bloc with 30% duties starting August 1. Šefčovič traveled to Washington this past week to try to understand whether a deal was still possible. While U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer suggested the 10% baseline tariff the two sides had negotiated still made sense, Lutnick suggested the levy would still need to be higher, a European diplomat said. Šefčovič left his meetings with the understanding that the U.S. was pressing for a baseline tariff of 15% or more, people briefed on the matter said. Šefčovič was also told the U.S. tariffs on the bloc's automotive sector were expected to stay at their current 25% level, and pharmaceutical tariffs could be introduced at 100%, one of the people said. France and some other EU nations had long pushed for the EU to take a tougher stance against the US, while Germany had encouraged the bloc to seek a quick, preliminary deal with Trump. German leaders initially understood Trump's letter threatening 30% tariffs as a last-minute ploy to extract better conditions. They finally snapped after finding out about U.S. officials' pressure this past week for the EU to accept higher baseline tariffs and no relief for its auto sector. The shift persuaded Berlin to open the door to retaliation, an official with knowledge of the situation said. Member states now need to determine how many more concessions they might be willing to make to get a deal, and which countermeasures to take if negotiations fail, an EU diplomat said Friday. All options will hurt, the diplomat said. Retail. After pledging to keep prices low, Amazon hiked them on hundreds of essentials. While Walmart cut prices on low-cost goods, Amazon raised them. By Shane Schiffer, Nate Ratner, Sebastian Herrera, and Brian Witten. In January, this can of Campbell's New England clam chowder cost less than $2 on Amazon. This month, that same soup cost $2.58 on Amazon, a 30% increase. In the 5 months since President Trump first announced sweeping tariffs, Amazon quietly raised prices on low-cost products such as deodorant, protein shakes, and pet care items, a Wall Street Journal analysis of nearly 2,500 items found. In April, Amazon said it would hold the line on prices. The journal's analysis of prices from e-commerce data firm Tragent Data found that while Amazon's price rose on 1,200 of its cheapest household items, competitor Walmart lowered prices on the same items by nearly 2%. The divergent strategies show how major retailers are reshaping prices on popular products as uncertainty about tariffs drags on. Amazon said the products tracked by the journal weren't representative of the company's prices overall. We have not seen the average prices of products offered in our store change up or down appreciably, the company said in a statement. Our commitment to offering low prices, not relative percentage changes, is what delivers the most value to our customers. Manufacturers of several of the products that became more expensive on Amazon say they haven't raised the prices they charge retailers. Even domestically made goods, such as the Made in USA Campbell's soup, saw increases. Imported goods and products with mixed origins, domestically assembled with imported components, faced even steeper hikes. Take the stackable metal baskets from Ohio-based Dayglo LLC, which imports from China and other countries. Before mid-February, Amazon sold it for $9.31. By late April, Amazon had lifted the price to $19.99. Dayglo hasn't changed the prices it charged Amazon despite paying more on its imported goods, according to Nick Morris-Rowe, the company's CEO. Any container I had that was coming took a cost increase basically overnight, he said of steel tariffs that came into effect last month. The lowest cost goods on Amazon saw one of their largest single day increases on February 15, 2 days after Trump signed an order suggesting tariffs would apply to most U.S. trading partners. Many of the products tracked by the journal are everyday essentials on Amazon, a category that represents one of every three units sold on Amazon in the U.S. during the first quarter of 2025, the company said. Amazon struggles to turn a profit on these products because shipping costs erase the already thin margins, said Corey Thomas, an Amazon vendor consultant. Walmart can afford to lose money on similar online sales because customers often buy more profitable items in stores, he added. Prices fluctuate for various reasons, including seasonal discounts, competition, and inflation, which accelerated last month. Amazon said the products analyzed by the journal were out of stock more frequently on competitors' websites. Some more expensive items in the journal's analysis decreased in price as new versions were introduced. Prices fell during Amazon Prime Day sales event that ran between July 8th and July 11th and have since rebounded, though they remain below their July 1 levels. Trump's recent delay of the tariff deadline to August 1 also gives retailers time to stockpile products before higher rates go into effect. Retailers say they have tried everything to keep a lid on price increases, including pressuring suppliers and dropping free perks at offices. Target said it gives priority to other cost control measures before raising prices, while Walmart said the data reflects its reputation for affordable pricing. The broader retail response to tariffs has been relatively muted. Prices for imported goods are up about 2% since March, according to research from Harvard economist Alberto Cavallo and members of the Harvard Business School's Pricing Lab. The lack of clarity may be causing retailers to implement price changes more cautiously and incrementally, Cavallo said. Many brands and retailers have used coded language when discussing pricing strategy with investors, fearing political backlash. Earlier this year, Amazon backed away from a plan to display tariff impacts on its bargain website, Hall, after the White House called the plan a hostile and political act. Trump warned businesses in May to eat the tariffs after Walmart said higher tariffs would result in higher prices. for Morris Row, whose company faced potential 145% tariffs on Chinese goods already in transit when the plan was announced, that directive carried real weight. Had they stayed at 145%, we would have been shutting down here, he said. Instead, his company paid the 30% tariff after Trump reduced the rate. Daigle is now negotiating with manufacturers, searching for suppliers outside China, and considering raising prices. For now, Morris Row said he's doing exactly what Trump asked, eating the tariffs. Exclusive central banking. How Bessent made the case to Trump against firing Fed Chair Powell. Some Republicans have laid the groundwork to oust the central bank chief, but the Treasury Secretary cited practical obstacles and economic hazards by Brian Schwartz and Nick Timiraos. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent in recent days privately laid out his case to President Trump for why he believed Trump shouldn't try to oust Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, people familiar with the matter said. Bessent's reason for avoiding a messy dispute over Powell's final 10 months as Fed chair focused on a few themes: the possible effects on the economy and markets, the prospect that the Fed is already moving toward cutting interest rates later this year, and the likely political and legal obstacles that such a move would face, these people said. Bessent said firing Powell was unnecessary because the economy is doing well and markets have responded positively to the president's policies, according to one of the people familiar with the matter. Bessent also reminded Trump that Fed officials have signaled they could cut rates twice before year's end, this person said. The possibility of the president attempting to fire Powell has been in the air for months, but it exploded into public view again this past week. Trump has repeatedly complained that the Fed needs to cut rates to lower federal debt expenses, and a senior White House official on Wednesday said the president had indicated to GOP lawmakers at a recent meeting he could soon move to fire Powell. Later on Wednesday, Trump told reporters that he wasn't planning to do so. The episode briefly churned up financial markets. Many investors think attempting to replace central bank officials over policy disputes could steadily erode the central bank's independence or its authority to take unpopular steps when necessary to maintain low inflation. The Wall Street Journal reported in April that Bessent and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick advised Trump against attempting to oust Powell when the president publicly mused about the Fed leader's termination. In this latest episode, Bessent told Trump that if he fired Powell before the conclusion of his term, the Fed chair could sue, and that lawsuit might drag into the spring, coinciding with the end of Powell's term anyway. On his Truth Social platform Sunday, Trump wrote that he didn't need Bessent to explain to him that firing Powell would be bad for the market. Nobody had to explain that to me. I know better than anybody what's good for the market and what's good for the USA, Trump wrote. People don't explain it to me. I explain it to them. Some advisors in the president's orbit have acknowledged that even without a probable court challenge from Powell, any attempted removal could create a prolonged leadership vacuum because there is no guarantee the Senate, typically away from Washington in August, would quickly confirm a replacement. Firing Powell over the objection of several GOP senators could frustrate the confirmation process for any successor. Under current law, the Fed's vice chair serves in the chair's absence. Vice Chair Philip Jefferson is a Biden appointee and Powell ally. These advisors have conceded that financial market and practical obstacles to pushing out Powell risk a lose-lose scenario for Trump. The administration owns the cost of adverse market reactions without the benefit of gaining immediate influence over monetary policy. Beyond the immediate obstacles, Bessent also told the president he is already well on his way to putting his stamp on the Fed. Fed Governor Adriana Kugler's term ends in January. Powell's term as chair ends in May. That will give Trump one or two vacancies to fill early next year. A White House spokesman said Trump will nominate the best possible candidate to restore competence, confidence, and accountability at the Federal Reserve. Trump's renewed consideration of firing Powell coincided with administration officials laying out a new line of attack by challenging his oversight of the renovation of two historic buildings that will serve as its headquarters in Washington. The project has seen large cost overruns that the Fed has blamed on rising material costs and unanticipated construction challenges. A handful of Powell's Senate critics have called on him to resign, but at least three Republicans on the Senate Banking Committee have said that they don't believe the Fed chair can or should be dismissed. Senate Majority Leader John Thune raised similar concerns on Wednesday, telling Fox News, "I think the markets want an independent Federal Reserve." Bessent's cautious approach marks a contrast to other administration officials who have entertained more aggressive tactics. Trump told reporters on Tuesday he feels Bessent is soothing. White House Budget Director Russell Voigt has been leading the campaign to pressure Powell over Fed construction cost overruns, potentially laying groundwork for a for-cause removal that could sidestep legal protections. As part of that effort, Trump recently installed three advisors, including one who works directly for Voigt on a local planning commission. That commission signed off on the Fed's design plans in 2021. Those advisors and Voigt have threatened to seek a more comprehensive audit of the Fed's construction and financial decisions. Those advisors also asked to visit the Fed's construction site, and the Fed offered a Friday evening tour. James Blair, a deputy chief of staff, told reporters on Friday afternoon. He said the time didn't work and asked to reschedule for next week. Voigt has been coy about whether the pressure campaign could serve as a predicate for attempting a for-cause removal of the Fed chair that sidesteps a recent Supreme Court order. Bessent said that this past week, the Fed chair succession process is already underway. Senior economic advisor Kevin Hesset is seen by many in Trump's orbit as the current frontrunner. Trump has been considering announcing his pick to replace Powell by September, according to previous reporting by the Journal. But declaring Powell's replacement sooner could satisfy the president's desire to more immediately influence rate policy without triggering potential chaos from attempting to remove Powell. There are a lot of great candidates, and we will see how rapidly it progresses. It's President Trump's decision, and it will move at his speed, Bessent said this past week in an interview on Bloomberg Television. Some advisors have indicated in recent days that they could consider a broader range of candidates, including some whose names haven't surfaced publicly, according to some of the people. The hope is that a greater number of surrogates will take to the airwaves and publicly pressure the Fed to lower rates. Asia. Chinese rare earth magnet exports surge after U.S. trade truce. Despite a detente on China's restrictions on the critical manufacturing inputs, shipments remain far below last year's levels, by Rebecca Feng. China's exports of rare earth magnets last month increased nearly threefold from the previous month after the country lifted some export controls on the critical industrial inputs following a deal with the U.S. Still, export levels remain significantly lower than in previous years, prompting some Western companies to seek long-term alternatives. In year-over-year terms, total export volumes of rare earth magnets from China decreased 38% in June from a year earlier, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of Chinese customs data released on Sunday. Though such a large decline is hardly cause for celebration among Western manufacturers that have come to depend on Chinese rare earth magnets to keep their production lines humming, the figure marks something of a recovery from May, when exports of these magnets tumbled 74% from a year earlier, the biggest such percentage decline in more than a decade. In June, China exported 3.2 million kilograms of rare earth magnets, nearly three times the 1.2 million kilograms exported in May. However, exports of rare earth magnets are still far below last year's levels, when monthly shipments averaged 4.8 million kilograms. China's dominant position in supplying rare earth magnets and metals has proven a powerful trump card in trade negotiations with the U.S. After years in which China took market share from the West, the country now produces about two-thirds of the world's rare earth minerals and processes around 90% of the supply. Rare earth magnets are essential in products such as car motors and missile guidance systems. China's exports of rare earth magnets to the U.S. in particular continue to fall sharply in June, dropping 52% from a year earlier to roughly 353,000 kilograms. As steep as that fall is, it represents an improvement from May's 93% year-over-year plunge in Chinese rare earth magnet exports to the U.S. As U.S.-China trade tensions soared in early April, Beijing said it would begin requiring licenses for exports of certain rare earth metals, including dysprosium and terbidium. Following a truce between the U.S. and China in Geneva in mid-May, Beijing pledged to ease exports of rare earth magnets. However, Western companies said they still weren't receiving enough magnets for their factories, and Chinese authorities continued to take weeks to scrutinize their applications, the journal reported. Further, applications for rare earths, which are used to make magnets, have rarely been granted. Beijing is increasing domestic oversight by addressing the smuggling of rare earth materials. China's Ministry of Commerce recently asked rare earth companies based in China to list employees with technical expertise, research background, and personal information, the journal has reported. The aim is to prevent the authorized sharing of trade secrets. The latest government body to join in is the country's powerful spy agency. In a social media post Friday, China's Ministry of State Security accused overseas intelligence agencies from unnamed countries of stealing restricted rare earth materials. Western manufacturers are increasingly preparing for a scenario in which Chinese rare earth export restrictions are here to stay. To prepare for potential near-term shortages of magnets and production shutdowns, some Western companies have shelled out for expensive air freight shipments to receive rare earth product supplies as soon as licenses are granted. Some manufacturers are also exploring ways to make their products with less powerful magnets that don't include any controlled rare earths. And that's all we have time for today. This brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.